Welcome to Unbridled Aloud, a series of conversations with writers sponsored by Unbridled Books. I'm your host, Kay Callison. We're also asking the authors to read a little bit from their books to give you a taste of what we're talking about as we go along. On this program, we're talking with the very popular Timothy Shaffert about his third novel, Devils in the Sugar Shop. Timothy Shaffert was born and raised on a farm in Nebraska. He graduated from the University of Nebraska and took his MFA at the University of Arizona. In a departure from his first two novels, Devils in the Sugar Shop is set in Omaha, where he now lives and works. And although we agree with the New York Times in saying that Timothy Shaffert does not take his material lightly, he only makes it seem that way, Devils is definitely his most overtly comical novel. It takes place all on one nasty winter's day, just before Valentine's, featuring a core cast of mostly female characters and their families, including ex-husbands, drawn from the artsy Old Market District in downtown Omaha. The women are all headed that evening to a sex toy party hosted by one of their own, Dee Dee, a divorcee who has gotten rich selling sugar shop products in the surrounding suburbs and small towns. The absurd and zany events of this day, complete with all kinds of crossed wires like a salacious missent email, and teenagers crashing a suburban swinging party in costume, feature strong supporting and cameo appearances from the Omaha cross-dressing set and a mysterious, strangely sexy dwarf photographer who has had reconstructive surgeries to make his arms and legs longer. As you might surmise, the lives and relationships of these core characters are in varying states of dysfunction or transition, heightened by the pre-Valentine's Day tension. The following scene features the three major core characters: Ashley, a failed erotic novelist; Viv, a visual artist who supports herself teaching drawing classes; and the aforementioned Dee Dee. They're meeting for happy hour at their favorite place, La Buvette, a popular and actual Omaha wine bar and grocery.
At the front of La Buvette, the walls on either side of the front door were not really walls at all, but rather French doors of a sort that unlocked and unlatched down the middle, the wine bar and grocery having originated years ago as a fruit stand in the marketplace. In the spring, the waiters pulled open the walls and pushed the tables out, and the sunlight rushed in to make everyone squint and perk up. Ashley felt transported whenever she saw those doors open on the first warm day of the year. Omaha was at its most magical when it most resembled some other city. "Smell me," Dee Dee said the second she arrived, holding out the back of her hand. She'd gone home to clean up. She still wore that pelt of chinchilla, but beneath it now was a violet-colored dress swirled with paisley. "Smells like cedar chips in a guinea pig's cage, right? It's spray on pan." She pulled her hand back and sniffed at herself, wrinkling her nose. Dee Dee ordered a shot of chilled Southern Comfort from Jones, the waiter they always demanded, a skinny 20-something with a drooping faux hawk who played the dulcimer in an indie band. "What are you thieving now?" Dee Dee asked. Ashley had taken out her little notebook and golf pencil. "Spray on tan," she said. "Guinea pig cage." Since her new erotic novel was meeting with rejection, Ashley was de-sexing it and repeopling it, taking notes, filling the book with her friends and family's oddball idiosyncrasies. Maybe she would render this book impossibly personal, unpublishable. She missed old life already, in many ways, back when publishing a novel had been simply a dream. And now Peyton was in college, Lee, weirdly, almost of age, Troy, so suddenly mysterious, despite her having gotten to know him backward and forward many years ago. She thought ahead and saw herself, an old lady, wishing she'd recorded all those years of conversation with Viv and Dee Dee at La Buvette. The fact that she had never done, and would probably never do, something so impractical and lovely for her elderly self broke her heart in two. "I might have to kill you off in the book, though," Ashley said with a sigh, feeling sentimental. "The novel needs some kind of significant death." "Kill me all you want," Dee Dee said, taking out her pack of menthols. "Just don't make me fat." Dee Dee, self-conscious now, fiddled with her tennis bracelet as her cigarette smoked between her fingers. Okay, I can't wait for Viv. I have to tell you now, Dee Dee said. I just called Zeke on his cell phone a little bit ago and asked him out for a drink, and he said yes. Now, I know it could be nothing, but even if it's nothing, it's kind of something, don't you think? Viv was relieved that her drinking compatriots were perched, per usual, at their back table. Their Saturday get-togethers felt like a reunion of sorts. When Ashley and Dee Dee had been mothers of young children, they'd become cut off from the world as if vaguely diseased, their sons and daughters acting on them like a debilitating bug caught on a vacation to an underdeveloped country. Back then, Ashley and Dee Dee couldn't drink much, couldn't have parties in their homes. You could call them at any hour of the day, and they'd sound beat and frazzled. They weren't the mothers that Viv had hoped they'd be, unimpressed by their children and mostly indifferent to their needs. Viv got to the table just as Mrs. Bloom approached it, jingling the change in a coffee can beneath their noses. Viv sat, then stilled the wobble of the table with a crumpled gum wrapper she stuck beneath one of the legs. I'm doing a quick collection to raise money for the legal representation of the teenage girl who burnt her house down in South O, Mrs. Bloom said. You haven't heard? She dropped a match in her baby brother's crib, and the whole house of sticks went up in a puff of smoke. They want to send her to jail, but she's been raped all her life. Cousins, uncles, stepdaddies, neighbors, friends of the family, they've all had their turn. It's time for her to have a chance to rise above her circumstances. As Ashley dug through the pockets of her jeans, Dee Dee said, Damn it, wish I could, Mrs. Bloom, but I am flat busted. I just punched up my account at the ATM and mobs flew out. That new house, you know. She pulled at the V of the front of her dress to show the safety pin keeping her bra together. And the bra came from Walmart to begin with. I'm not even sure how I'm going to pay for my whiskey. As a matter of fact, could I trouble you? Would it be rude if I... And she tentatively reached her forefinger and thumb into the can to pinch the corner of a sawbuck. Mrs. Bloom slapped Dee Dee's wrist and walked off, huffy. You love to torture, Mrs. Bloom, Ashley said. Viv had dropped a $20 bill into Mrs. Bloom's coffee can, though she hadn't been able to completely follow the story. Her mind caught on the baby in the burning bed. Viv asked, Would you all do it over again? And Ashley and Dee Dee looked at each other, wondering what she was talking about. Have kids, I mean. They could have just grown up to burn your house down, got revenge on you for all they think you did to them. Well, Ashley said, sure. My daughter's very spoiled, and my son's very gay and very handsome, and I'm not being homophobic here, but that just strikes me as a deadly combination. I mean, he'll be devoured, won't he, once he's out in that tragic little world? Ever since Ashley's son had come out of the closet, many of the Saturday conversations had revolved around diagnosing just exactly when Ashley should have known and what, had she known when she should have known, she should have done. What kept the conversations from veering into homophobia, they assured each other, was the fact that the gay men they knew, even the ones they'd accidentally dated in the past, were the only men they tended to trust with all their hearts. But yeah, Ashley said, I'd do it again, no question. I love Naomi, Dee Dee said, but Zeke and I were so young, even though we didn't know it then. In all honesty, if I somehow had the chance to do it all differently, I'd be very, very tempted to do it all differently. Do you think that's why you divorced, Viv asked? Because you married too young? Who knows, Dee Dee said.
Timothy Shaffert, reading from Devils in the Sugar Shop. I'm Kay Callison. Timothy Shaffert, can you have lunch again in Omaha after this novel?
Sure. It's set in Omaha, but the people aren't real, and people enjoy reading references to places that they know, and so for the most part, I think people will be pleased by this portrait of Omaha, because it's fun-loving, I guess, and non-threatening, because like I said, I'm not exposing anything. It's all fiction.
Can you identify how the novel started for you?
I knew I wanted to write a novel set in one day in the style of some of my favorite modernist novels or modernist writers like Virginia Woolf or James Joyce. And so it was a little bit of an experiment, and I wanted to have a bunch of different characters. And I was also thinking of the filmmaker Robert Altman, who often does large ensemble casts all set within a short period of time with some kind of event bringing all the characters together.
Well, what about the setting of Omaha as a place where there is a swinging scene out in the suburbs. And then there's also the sex toy business and the sex toy parties. Was that integral in your notion of what you wanted to write about?
I guess those are things that kind of helped me guide the book. I don't know that that was one of the things that I definitely wanted to write about, but it's something that showed up in the characters' lives and helped me write towards an ending, I guess, if you want to put it that way. But I knew that, you know, you mentioned the swinging subculture. I mean, I'd written about that already for an alternative news weekly that I used to write for here in Omaha. And I was approached by the editor, said, well, we want you to write about the swinging culture. And I said, well, I don't know anything about the swinging culture. How do I find out? And she was like, well, I don't know. I think they hang out at this one bar. Of course, the internet made me aware that there really was a pretty thriving culture, that there were websites, there were groups, there are actually national organizations with local chapters that can help you find other couples. And ultimately, I did interview some other couples online.
Ah, I wondered about that.
Yeah. And it was interesting. And the things that I found out did kind of stay in my mind, and I thought about doing maybe a nonfiction book, maybe interviewing those people more and interviewing some other people and actually maybe going to a party. But I'm a fiction writer, and so what I ended up thinking about were the characters kind of on the periphery of that life, these people that are perhaps intrigued by this world or have some kind of connection to it but aren't necessarily fully involved or don't make that part of their lives. Those were the stories that were putting themselves together, so that subculture, that swinging subculture, just became an element of the book and not what the book was about.
But what about the sex toy stuff? Did you go to one of those parties?
Oh yeah, I've been to one of those, and practically every woman I know has been to at least one, and it's...
You're kidding. Around here they just do wall sconces and
candles and Tupperware and yeah, but no, this
and baskets.
Oh yeah, the baskets.
But you spend half your life escaping from having to go to one of those things.
Absolutely. And maybe that's why these kinds of sex toy parties thrive. But you know, people throw them for bachelorette parties or in lieu of wedding showers, or it's just a kind of unique alternative, I guess, and there seem to be a lot of people who throw those kinds of parties.
When you worked on this novel, did you actually have a plot outline of the things that you wanted to have happen that day, or did you work real hard and come up with this core cast of characters and then kind of just follow them around?
You know, it's funny because, you know, I started writing for the characters, actually with no even real sense that it was going to be a novel. I mean, when I was first writing about Dee Dee, I thought I was writing a short story. And then as I was writing about Dee Dee, I met her old friend Ashley, and I thought, well, that might be interesting to go into Ashley's mind next. So as I started to put it together, it was building from the characters, and then you know, it becomes kind of like a puzzle, and you start to piece things together, and you can kind of think, oh, well, they could go this way, they could go... Plus, I was working with an actual place, too, so it was fun to be able to think, oh, well, I want them to be at La Bouvette during happy hour, or they should be at the bookstore as it's opening in the morning, or whatever. It's hard for me to really separate those different kinds of processes, whether it came from characterization or plot. I mean, it was really just kind of, you go with the flow, you know, as things occur to me. They could be occurring to me because the characters are dictating it, or it could be because the plot's dictating it. But I didn't draw anything out like any specific plot plan. I knew that I wanted it to end up at this swingers party, but I didn't even know what was going to happen at the swingers party or who was going to go. So, and then eventually, you know, you meet these other characters and you realize, oh, well, these characters show up here. And yeah, so that's kind of the process.
Were there challenges in managing the material, having it happen just on the course of one day?
Yeah, there were, I mean... There were definitely things that you couldn't quite do. Sometimes you had to do things in a shorthanded manner, you know, because especially since they're all getting ready for this party as well. So you couldn't have scenes that otherwise, if I wasn't writing on one day, I might leap ahead a week or something, or see what happens to these characters later on, or I might have a flashback or something. But there was something about setting it all in one day that really demanded that things be kind punchy and that you not have a lot of exposition and that the characters reveal themselves through the things that they say to each other and the things that they do. So I don't know that it was necessarily any more challenging than any other kind of a book, but it just had its own different set of rules.
Timothy Schaffer, talking about Devils in the Sugar Shop. I'm Kay Callison. Now, if you were to draw a map of the setting of this novel, you'd find that the place where all paths cross is a rare and used bookstore named Mermaid Singing. The owners are 20-something identical twins, Peach and Plum. Here, they are talking about going to the sex toy party that night. It's being held in the loft of Ashley, who is the wife of Peach's lover, Troy, and Peach has been reading a book by a trendy self-help author on fairy tale types of mistresses wives should look out for. Peach, to her dismay, has identified herself as the worst of the lot, Goldilocks, who sleeps in your bed, snoops in your kitchen, tries out your lipstick, and moreover, is taking Ashley's class and writing about her affair with Ashley's husband as her assignment.
"You're coming to Ashley's sugar shop party with me tonight, right?" Peach asked. "Nope," Plum said. "Why not?" Peach asked, whining, gnawing ferociously at a hangnail. "Because I love not going places. It's my new passion." "I can't go by myself, Lum Lum," she said, resorting to nostalgic name-calling. Peach called Plum Lum Lum just infrequently enough for it to maintain its impact, tickling her with its unmistakable sisterliness. "You and Ashley are buddies," Peach said. "You can talk to her about literature. What are you bookish girls reading these days? Valley of the Dolls?" "You act so dumb sometimes," Plum said. "Why do you do that? Do you think it makes you prettier?" But Plum knew that Peach, no bookworm by any means, had long been wanting to give up mermaid singing. Peach wanted to go broke owning her own theater, playing the characters she'd someday grow too old to pull off. But Peach hated filling out forms. By the time she got any arts funding, she'd be an 80-year-old Ophelia, a burnt-out Electra. The bark and shriek of a domestic dispute slipped in from the street through a window at the front of the store, open a crack to let in gusts of cool air. The shop was frequently sweltering as the condos upstairs were overrun with the elderly. In particular, there seemed to be a surfeit of septuagenarian divorcees in greasy fur coats succumbing to mange, always flaunting their grandfathered-in kitty cats, pets were no longer allowed, and constantly complaining to maintenance of the cold. Because of the onion-thin skin of this slow parade of battle axes, Plum and Peach sweltered in the winter months. "Oh, it looks like an ugly one," Peach said, walking to the front to watch the couple pass. She stood at the door on tiptoes to see over the blue-finned, red-nippled mermaid reading Colette painted on the glass. "An ugly what?" Plum said. She walked to the window seat and raised the slat of the blinds. "An ugly husband? An ugly wife? An ugly fight? Look how he's getting in her face like that." "But she can't just walk away, can she?" Plum murmured. "Is he going to slug her? Should we call the police?" "No, he won't slug her," Peach said. "At least not until they get home. Then, bap, a knuckle sandwich." "But maybe not," Plum said. "Maybe things are different when they're at home, in the dark of their kennel. At home, they just break open a bottle of Us Against the World and anesthetize. Maybe it's only when they're out in the city, faced with everything they don't got, that they turn on each other." After silence, Peach said, "What am I doing, Plum?" "Ah, that little lover tango's got you thinking," Plum said, sitting on the cushions of the window seat, drawing her knees up, putting her arms around them. "It's like a metaphor for your affair." "Oh, stop," Peach said. She sat next to Plum. Peach's skin was all goosebumpy, and Plum reached over to rub some warmth into her arms. "Everything can be a metaphor for an affair," Peach said. "Because our feelings for other people, that's all anybody's ever really thinking about at any given minute, isn't it? Am I happy alone? Am I happy married? Am I having enough sex? Am I having too much? Is he unhappier than I am?" "I really can't judge you, I have to confess," Plum said. She stood and walked to a mirror on the wall, clipping and unclipping her earring, a costume jewelry cluster of silvery rhinestones she'd gotten for a nickel. Toying with the earring seemed the gesture of a soap opera socialite burdened with the tummy aches of guilt. "I've developed a little crush on someone else," she said. "I don't deserve Mickey." Ah, Peach said, nodding toward the window. Metaphor yourself. Maybe, Plum said. I think I'm going to cheat on him. Pfft, Peach said, an expression she and Plum had affected as girls sitting around in the summer, poring over their dad's old Mad magazines. It's true. It's not, Peach said. You would never cheat on Mickey. I don't even want to hear about your stupid crush. Oh, listen to you, Plum said, turning away from the mirror to glare at Peach. You describe to me every lurid, carnal detail of your sex life with Troy, and I can't even talk about a flirtation. She sat at the desk and picked up the sugar shop invite, along with its free coupon. 50% off Garbo's Tulip, it read, for that sophisticated lady who just wants to be alone. The satiny Garbo's Tulip hypnotizes with its gentle massage knots and patented angel pocket. Fits discreetly in any purse, evening clutch, or makeup bag. Includes faux mink-lined velveteen satchel in one of three tastefully muted colors, gilded lily, platinum blonde, or champagne bubble. I've never described carnal details, Peach said. You don't have to, Plum said. We share a diseased brain. Plum had a little scar on her nipple to the right of her eye from a tricycle spin-out when she was 4. Peach had a scar on her cheek to the left of her ear from taking a spill in a rose bush when she was 5. They had long liked to tell people the scars were their only evidence of ever having been conjoined at the head, having been expertly severed from each other in infancy in a hospital incubator.
Timothy Shaffer, reading from Devils in the Sugar Shop. I'm Kate Callison. We resume our conversation talking about Peach and Plum. Plum seems to me to maybe be the sanest character in the novel, and Peach as the one who is, well, I think of her as, the troublemaker, the stirrer-upper of things.
Right, right. And Plum resents Peach for her beauty and her devil-may-care attitude and her free spirit of sorts, even though Plum clearly has it more together. And in creating this store, she's created a warm place, a place where people find comfort among the books.
And then Peach is quite the opposite in terms of her effect on others.
Yeah, and that's part of Peach's mission in the novel, I think, is to realize that she is destructive and that she comes to some harsh realizations about herself by the end of the book.
She's also the foil for Ashley, Allison's concern that her marriage isn't going well. She suspects that something is going on, and in fact, the something going on is that Troy is having an affair with Peach.
Right. And so as these characters were interacting with us, throwing them into these various situations, I could see places where different characters could connect, because I wanted these characters to know each other and to interact on one level. Meanwhile, there's this other kind of interaction going on that they don't know about, and other conversations that involve them that they're not in on. And so there's all this happening on the surface, and then there's all this happening beneath the surface, too.
In The Singing and Dancing Daughters of God, you consciously use the Halloween season. And in this novel, you have apparently consciously used Valentine's Day.
If I had thought of it at first, if I thought, okay, I want to write this novel about these screwed-up relationships and I want it to take place around Valentine's Day, I mean, I probably would have thought, that's too obvious. Yeah, or something like that. But it came from the circumstances, and I knew I wanted to set it in this kind of snowy winter day. So then that's when I started thinking about maybe the too-muchness of it is actually what'll make it work. And I liked the idea of these complicated marital lives and infidelities and sexual lives, and that all of this is taking place during this invention, this holiday that's thick with heart-shaped things and candy and sweetness.
And sex toys.
Sex toys. And in a sense, humiliation and despair and frustration and depression, the things that that people feel as that holiday approaches, because it is promoting a kind of falsity.
And it's on a nasty, nasty winter's day.
Right, right. It's a kind of limbo for the characters, I guess.
Ashley Allison teaches a class in erotic fiction. And one thing that she observes is that none of these women know what turns a woman on. And that's strange to me. What does that say about them?
Right. Ashley is frustrated because the work in this erotica class is turning out not to be sexy. And, I mean, there are some theories that come out in that class that it's because so much of the sex industry and what is considered sexual is determined by men and sold to men. So the characters, in a sense, are kind of, I mean, you have Ashley who writes erotic novels and teaches this erotic writing workshop, and you have Dee Dee who sells the sex toys at the sex toy parties, and you have Viz who creates provocative artwork. And so they're all kind of on the fringe of a sort of sex industry, I guess.
Well, when did the flirt, the stalker, arise in the novel's composition?
Yeah, there's a stalker who's actually taking photos from a magazine of women in a local magazine, and he's pasting, cutting out their heads and hands and feet and pasting them onto the pages of pornographic magazines to models, naked models, and sending these pages directly to the women. The stalker became like a literal representation of the character's insecurities. So like Viz, for example, who's part of this magazine spread that's getting these pornographic pictures in the mail, she doesn't feel more glamorous or more fashionable by being featured in this magazine. It just draws attention to her own fears of growing older. And she feels like it draws attention to the fact that she's unmarried. So I guess the stalker became a kind of personification, and then also the stalker was doing a kind of collage art, I guess. And so that even Viv herself becomes curious as to thinking that it's some kind of performance art, you know, and she wants to work it into her own art form. And so as those elements develop, then I realized that, well, I want the stalker to be an element that carries the reader through, that it can become another kind of tension that's outside of the control of these women's lives. I mean, you can decide who you marry, or you divorce, or you have your affair with, or whatever, but when you've got these outside forces, the devices that this stalker is using to approach the women with, you know, these pornographic pictures, it's another assertion of the culture's sex industry. That's actually kind of startling.
If you were going to tell the reader something very important that you want them to take away from this novel, what would that be?
I guess I always say with all my books that you got to read them with a sense of humor and a sense of irony, I suppose. Some people probably would not accuse me of being a realist, but I feel like the characters are real and that they do react in realistic ways. And definitely there are a lot of unlikely and absurd things that happen within the world of this book, but, you know, unlikely and absurd things happen in life. And sometimes when we're approaching fiction, we approach it expecting different kinds of, or with our own set of rules for the way that a fictional world should be represented that is not necessarily in keeping with the way the world actually is. I guess, you know, I want a reader to hopefully recognize that even though the characters say funny things and that the situations are sometimes ridiculous, that really, you know, there's some truth at the heart of it all.
Well, Timothy Shaffer, thanks so much for talking with us today about Devils in the Sugar Shop.
And thank you so much.
Timothy Shaffer, our featured writer today on Unbridled Aloud. Other writers we're talking with include Elise Blackwell, Andrea Portes, and Mark Cunningham. For more information about Devils in the Sugar Shop and Timothy Shaffer's first two novels, The Phantom Limbs of the Rollo Sisters and The Singing and Dancing Daughters of God, plus other titles from Unbridled Books, check out their website at unbridledbooks.com. You'll find all kinds of interesting stuff there, including book study guides for most of their titles and a long list of literary links. This program was produced by Kay Callison for Unbridled Books, who promise you that rarest of pleasures, a good read. For other interviews with authors of fine prose conducted by Kay Callison, also known as Kay Panetti, go to the American Audio Prose Library website at americanaudioprose.org. The music is by Tom Andes from his solo piano CD, One Voice. You can find it on Amazon.com. For Unbridled Aloud, this is Kay Callison.